Welcome to The Art of Authenticity, a weekly podcast that explores what it really means to be authentic and build a life that's truly you, featuring in-depth interviews with successful business leaders, entrepreneurs, authors, and thinkers. By sharing their stories, daily practices, and habits, they will help you find a life that is successful and authentic. I'm your host, Laura Coe, author, entrepreneur, and coach. Welcome to the show. Today we have Sebastian Marshall. He is in consulting, primarily growth and profitability in high tech and finance, and he has authored three books, including Gateless, a guide to improving all the key intangibles related to the modern world. He's also the executive director of Give, Get, Win, where talented individuals and companies donate their time, product, or service with 100% of the proceeds going to charity. In this week's episode, if you're interested in a deep dive into the idea of living an authentic life and how that works in real time when the realities of work, life, even failure arise, then this episode's for you. Sebastian is not here to talk about any other projects, simply how authenticity works in our modern world. Enjoy the show, and if you like what you hear, please subscribe, write a review. Thanks for listening.
Hi, Sebastian. Thank you so much for coming on the show.
Hey, Laura. I am jazzed to be here.
I'm excited today in particular because Sebastian and I were just chatting before we hopped on, and although he has written multiple books and done, you know, consulting and projects, and I mean, the list is endless, as you heard in the intro, Sebastian and I were chatting about the questions of authenticity, and we decided to make today a conversation much more engaged and in depth about what it means to live an authentic life. So the idea behind this podcast is that, you know, people who have a lot of success in their life, like you do, Sebastian, might look good from the outside. But the question is really to struggle with this idea of authenticity and what it means to actually feel good in your success. So what does an authentic life mean to you?
Sure. So I've got two big points, and I want to really engage with you, Laura, because I think it's amazing what you've been able to do. I don't want to just come and say, hey, here's my way, because this is a topic that I think I really want to explore with you. I think
awesome.
There's two points. I think there's first a feedback loop between reality and whatever your virtues, your values are, right? So you got to figure out what's possible and then try to live in harmony with that. And your first guess as to what's possible might be wrong. You might try to set things up a certain way and then have a big problem because it doesn't work. You know, it's the USSR, for instance, right? They had a, hey, we got this idea. It doesn't work. Okay, now what do we do, right?
Yeah.
And the second one is, you know, I think a lot about this, and we'll talk about this. I think we'll talk about this really in depth a little bit later in our show. But I think so much about the operationalization of integrity. So if you say to somebody, I'm going to help you with this, if they ask you for anywhere from a basic favor to something that's a big deal, and you say yes, how do you know that you'll actually be able to do that for them? And that ties in with the first point. That's you know, what's possible and then doing it. I think good intentions are great, but then how do you actually ensure that you're living up to the way that you want to live when sometimes it's very hard, it's very difficult, things go wrong? So kind of what's possible, getting on board with that, and then operationalizing it so you can stay on board with it. I think that's it.
That's so interesting. So what's possible, right? So we have this, I love what you said, a feedback loop with reality. And that has to start with an authentic voice within you first coming up with this creative concept, right?
It is. And I'm sure you're going to have other people on your show talk a lot about that and about listening to themselves. Here's the topic that I want to dialogue with you, because I think it's so controversial and it's so hard and it's so difficult. Let's say you're a parent and you always wanted to have kids that were extroverted and they went out and they had an amazing time and they're always just the life of the party and you're going to have every opportunity to do so. And then your first child's born and they're introverted and, you know, you could teach them social skills and have them get friends, but they're not suited to be the life of the party. They don't want to. Or you think, I'm going to build a company culture where we hire anybody and then we develop them and help them do this and that. And then you realize, well, actually, you know, we don't have a high success rate if we don't get people a certain technical background for this role.
Yes.
Right. So you say, oh, we're going to be anti-credential, you know, because we're going to be an anti-credential company. Right. We're going to we're going to take anybody and we're going to make them great because that's possible because I got a vision. I know we can do better than this. But then it's not.
Yeah.
Right. And it actually doesn't work. So you're trying to have a big vision, you know, basic stuff like, you know, I'm going to eat healthy. I'm going to make time for myself. I'm going to meditate. That's all possible. We know that's possible. Millions of people do that. That's kind of, you know, pick one and then operationalize it, right? But when you're really pushing the limit, you know, what's actually possible, you don't know if you're trying to be innovative or great. And then what do you do when you set a virtue that you think is good, but then doesn't actually work? So I turn that over to you.
I love this question. This is something that I feel so strongly about because I think the world throws around this idea of passion, authenticity, and they talk about it as if it's an island that you've arrived at. And now that I'm here, I have found my authentic space and I can just kick my feet up and relax and enjoy the rest of my life. Right. Like I'm happy now. Right. And I think that's the biggest myth of an authentic or passion, oriented life. And I think what you're saying has been my experience. I have built a business. I'm now writing this book and bringing out this podcast and these various things. And I feel really, really passionate about what I'm doing. It feels very authentic to me. But the realities of taking steps and then realizing, okay, that wasn't the right path. I mean, my God, Sebastian, just becoming a first-time author, realizing, okay, the world has changed in publishing. It's not what I thought. I thought I was going to write this book and that was kind of the whole deal. But, you know, self-publishing has started in platforms and blogging and all this stuff, right? And so you're in this feedback loop with reality and you have to keep making decisions, pivoting in the moment. And your authentic life is walking down this path, making decision after decision after decision. And part of it is failure, right? Like, I think that's absolutely correct. You're not going to just succeed because you're authentic. Often you're actually failing and failing and failing. And the question is, how do you recover from that? What do you do next? What's your next step, right? Has that been your experience?
Totally. I'll give you a really, really, really simple example. So I'm a very big fan of running controlled experiments, little tiny experiments to see if things suit me or not. Because I see all kinds of things that are like, oh, that seems like a good idea. I feel like a lot of people are like, you know, I'm going to get into kickboxing. And I'm really going to do it. I'm going to become a kickboxer. And for me, it's like, oh, I don't know if I'm going to like kickboxing or not. Let me try it for a fixed amount of time and then reassess. So I try to take that approach to everything that's new, where I'm coming in not like, I'm going to become a kickboxer. Oh, I failed to be a kickboxer. I'm trying to be like, let me try kickboxing for X amount of time. And not liking it is success too, because now I know that kickboxing doesn't suit me, or it does suit me, or maybe it's something to do casually. So I take that approach a lot. Now, I'm always looking for like, where's the line? What's actually possible? And that's what I mean by the feedback loop between, you know, reality and whatever your values are. Because recently I got really, really, really inspired with endurance training. And before I was never into endurance training. I like to lift weights. But like I'm naturally a guy that can put on bulk. I can lift weights. I can get muscular very easily. But like running, like not for me. I was never very good at it. That was like not my thing. And you know, it just like didn't come naturally to me. Wasn't very pleasurable to me. Whatever. But I started reading these books on this topic and getting really excited by it. So I saw, you know, I found books like Ultra Marathon Man and you know, books about people getting into ultra marathons and running 100 miles. And I'm just like, you know, this is so cool. I want to try this out. Bought a pair of running shoes, started getting into it, and started doing some running. So I did that. And, you know, before I had more of a, you know, person who lifts weights kind of diet, you know, relatively high calories, some bulk, you know, like my physique just fine. But I said, you know, I'm going to lean out a little bit, right? So I'm going to do something that I've done many times that totally works. I'm going to track all of my calories that I eat, and I'm going to aim for about a 500 calorie deficit a day. That corresponds to losing about 1 pound of weight per week. No big deal. It's pretty easy. I eat pretty clean and healthy. Totally got this. Oh, I did not have this. I started feeling miserable after like less than a week of this. Like just like upping my mileage and running more and like not eating enough food. Like my body was like not, like my body was having a really bad time. And at first I'm like, you know, I'm going to persist. I am done. I like got through my first week. And I said, okay, I got to cycle this off. I'm going to break down, right? So now I just said, okay, I don't know. I'll talk with other friends that have done training and like when, you know, do they cut during like recovery back off periods with running, or do they just, you know, do they get to some certain plateau first? Like I'll talk with other smart people. I'll go learn and research some more. But as of right now, I'm going to be picking between trying to grow my endurance training and up my mileage in running, or trying to do body composition, you know, more fat, less fat, more muscle, less muscle things. I'm not going to try to do both at the same time again, because like I tried and like I was about to break down. And I saw that early. I didn't like bullheadedly push, which maybe is what I would have done 3 years ago and just broken down. So I saw that it wasn't working. I really wanted it to work. I was really aggravated. It didn't work. It seemed like it should work, but it didn't work. So I'm like, okay, let me back off of this before my body breaks down and my training like falls apart and both my diet and my training fail. So I backed off it.
Yeah, because an authentic life means that you're constantly tuning into the compass within and you are making decisions as reality is happening and pivoting, right? So I think that's a great example. And I think a lot of people push through these things, man up, suck it up, right? Your body's breaking down. I'm just going to like push even harder because we're told, you know, that's what we do in tough times. And meanwhile, what seemed like a fun goal has now become something that you dread. It feels really heavy, right? And in my world, I call it emotional weight starts to pack on and you feel, you know, terrible. And so I think the idea that there's one authentic path and it looks a certain way is the opposite of authenticity, right? Like, it's like, I love the intersect of philosophy and spirituality. That's what I love to do. There's a million things under that umbrella, some of which will work out and some of which won't, right? I think some of it which might work out, but then I've changed. Maybe it's 5 years have passed and my interests have shifted. So I think that's an important myth that you're bringing up, that there's one way to look at it. It has to go a certain way. It has to look a certain way. And even if you're like just banging into the wall, don't look up, keep pushing harder, right? Like, I don't think that works at all.
So here's my question for you, and this is why I want to get into a dialogue, is like, when, sometimes it's obvious, but when it's not obvious, when is it like I'm being lame and I need to force myself to do the thing that I want to do, but I'm scared, or like I need to double down on this and just like, even though it's hard, I need to make time for this, versus like, this doesn't work. So when it's hard and not working, when do you double down and push through because it really matters? And when do you back off and reassess? And what's your tactical, operational way of doing? I have a couple thoughts on this, but I'd love to hear for you how you actually break it apart, not at a high level, but like if you set a goal or a plan and it's shaky, it's hard, seems to be kind of not working, when do you put your head down and say, I'm going to make this work, versus when do you say, you know what, I need to reprioritize. I need to rethink this, Laura. So what's your methodology here?
Yeah. I mean, you know, this is the thing I think I've spent the last few years thinking about endlessly. And for me, it's really comes down to, am I starting to dread it? Do I feel really heavy? Do I feel really weighed down? Is it something that has become emotionally toxic for me and I'm just pushing through? Or is it that I'm really excited to do it, but I'm starting to face some fears? I'm starting to push into an emotional obstacle I didn't plan on, right? Where I'm growing, I'm learning something, and I have resistance. And I think the taking the time to differentiate between the sense of dread and all the justifications for my dread, right? So I start to really weigh down, I don't want to do this thing. And I'm pushing through it anyways. And I've start to say things to myself like, okay, but if I quit, other people will disapprove. What will my parents think? What will my spouse think? My kid is going to think that I'm lame. Or you just, you know, you, this is such a, it's so important to finish things, right? You just have some kind of what I call junk food thoughts, just something that you've decided from culture, from family, from friends is why you should continue. That is the 100% indication it's time to quit. If you're still engaged and you are still passionate and you still see possibility and hope, but fear is set in, or you're just tired, you're starting to wear down a little. If fear is set in, then, you know, fear, I think you've just got to live next to. You've got to learn how to cohabitate with fear. And if you're just wearing down, take a vacation, take a break, like get a friend, go get a massage, go for a jog, take a week off. Like sometimes I think, especially entrepreneurs, right? But a lot of successful people, you're living your careers, and sometimes a few days off gets you a lot more traction than just keep pushing into it.
Totally. And, you know, if we want to dive into this on a basis, this, I know this is something you often cover late in the show, but if you want to talk at a couple of ways of how do you stay on top of being authentic, I would say a big one for me, of when do I ask those questions? For some people, they have a natural dialogue that happens all the time, and they're pretty good about listening to themselves. For me, I'm naturally not. So the things that you said about, am I dreading this? Am I doing this because I'm feeling like I have to, or I'm going to let somebody down? You know, am I doing this for the right reasons, you know, with a little bit of fear, or am I doing this for the wrong reasons and I'm feeling like I'm just chained to whatever this thing is that's in my life? For me, it's critical that I review weekly. I get lost. So my compass, my map making session is a weekly review. And the simplest version of a weekly review that I'll do is I'll ask three questions. Sometimes I'll do much more complicated and I'll look at a lot of things. But the simplest one that I'll do is I'll literally list out the last 7 days. Where was I each day, and like, what's the big things that I did? Right. So yeah. Like sometimes, you know, I had to fly twice in a week, and I try not to ever set up my schedule like this, but sometimes it happens. And then you're like, oh, how come nothing's happening? Everything's so harried and busy. It's like, oh, cause I had like 3 transit days this week out of 7. That's why. Yeah. Sometimes yeah. It's just like things are harried cause they're harried.
Yeah.
Right?
I call it celebrating the wins. Like you gotta actually deal on a daily basis with what you've achieved and looking at the things you've done and not just feeling bad about what you didn't do.
Yes. And then I ask 3 questions. What's going on? What matters? What doesn't?
Yep.
What's going on? What matters? What doesn't? So what's going on is my like, oh, I was like sick all week. That's why whatever didn't happen. Or like, oh, I was really busy on this and like, it was a good thing. And like, yeah, not the biggest, but it's done now. Whatever. What's going on? It's pretty straightforward. Though if I don't ask myself, sometimes I don't notice, especially like, you know, by the time I do my weekly reviews every Sunday, you know, by the time Sunday rolls around, a lot of times I've forgotten what happened on Tuesday, right? Maybe the first part of the week was great, and then the last 3 days were busy, right?
Does that give you an opportunity to be less self-critical?
You know, so it's interesting, right? Like, I think people, you know, when it comes to being self-critical, look at it a different way. For me, I don't associate... I think a lot of people immediately make a jump of like, I'm doing X, therefore, like, that this is the kind of person I am type things.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, I think about this all the time, Laura. I think all the time, like, how much agency do we have moment by moment? And like, we're about to go way off in the deep end, but at the risk of that, like, how much agency do we have moment by moment, right? So if you wake up and you always, you know, like run out the door without breakfast and then like get hungry and like go stop and buy a Dunkin' Donuts or something in the morning, right? Yeah. And you've just been doing this forever. And you like kind of sort of know that your life is going to be better if you make eggs and whatever in the morning. And that just suits you better. But you just most of the time don't. It's very unusual, right?
Yeah.
At this point, I'm taking it for granted, like the weather, that my default pattern of action will happen if I don't do something, like really like go out of my way to put effort on it. But then I don't beat myself up about it. And I think a lot of people do. Whereas I tend to assume that like a lot of my behavior is pre-programmed and shaped by the environment and the people around me and everything that's happening. So when I do dumb stuff, I try to look at it like a scientist of like, okay, like I got some data. What just happened here? So I try to really figure out like why things happened.
And I think this what matters, what doesn't as a habit allows you the opportunity to say, you know, I'm going to give myself a break on these things and focus on the things that matter, right? And move on to your next week, right? Without perseverating. I think so many people set up lists for their week that are unachievable.
I do.
And then the week starts and 10 things happen that you don't plan on. And instead of saying, you know what? Those things that happened, I actually consciously made the decision to do, and I'm happy I did them. People stare at the list they didn't do, and they just feel bad. And every week, people feel behind. And I think one of the biggest things I hear from highly successful people is that they just can't catch up. They're always out of time. They're always behind. And I think if you flip that script and say, okay, what did I get done this week? I'm really excited with myself and I got these things done. And although it didn't always, it's great to plan out your week, but the reality is it's also really great to change directions if something critical happens and you, you know, need to take care of it. So that's, you know, something to be proud of, not to say I didn't finish the list I set out to do.
Yeah. It's interesting, right? Like, so this is, I think about the operationalization of integrity a little bit. My good friend Kai, and he's definitely somebody that you should interview at some point. He's a really wonderful guy and he's very, very smart about operations and he's got the highest project success rate of anyone I know, high 90%, nothing he does fails. And he's got a really unique superpower, which is he knows how long things actually take. Mm. Nobody else does. Kai's the only one I know that does. There's a couple other people that are, you know, good at their jobs and are project managers or whatever, but he always knows how long something is going to take. So he bought a house recently, like a small place, but he started fixing it up and just, you know, he's buying it to do as a rental property, but like also a fun project. He's a programmer and this is something he could do with his hands. That's a little bit, it's still very cerebral in terms of you can be smart and engage with it, but it's not like intellectual. I'm in front of a keyboard. So he's like, you know, fixing it up and like doing the countertops and really having a blast. He booked himself a bunch of time to do this, like a couple of months. Right.
Okay.
And he says, I'm going to spend 2 months on this. And he starts getting the furniture and getting the decor or whatever. And then he finishes in like two, 3 weeks. And he's like, huh, okay, I'm done early. But he always estimates more time than he needs.
Yes. And some people are, I mean, I would say I'm much more like Kai than I am marketing sales strategy, right? Like, and I think people are very different with those skill sets. And so when you talk about Kai and his ability to plan, you know, be able to see things that take months or weeks or hours, and he just knows that naturally. That comes back to your second point about authenticity. Can you explain a little bit more what you mean in terms of doing that with integrity? When you say yes, how do you know if you're going to get it done? How does that relate to authenticity to you?
Sure. So Kai gets his place fixed up really nice and early, and he's really thrilled, goes away for 3 days, and his water boiler explodes in his basement.
Okay.
Place is covered in water, gets it all fixed up, has to redo a bunch of things, and it winds up taking exactly 2 months. Right. So he booked out 2 months, gets done early. Oh, that's great. Water boiler. Guess what? Water boilers explode in life. Right.
Right.
And if you're so leveraged on your to-do lists and your time that an illness of yourself or a family member is going to break your plans, then you haven't operationalized integrity. You've got it in your head. You want to do the right thing, whether the right thing is writing or practicing yoga or a martial art. Whether it's developing something for yourself, I tend to think that, and this is only one small slice of it, but I tend to think that that people greatly underestimate the amount of time it takes to do things.
Yes.
The amount of calendar time, the amount of labor, because a lot of times you're imagining things that all need to happen, right? Like if you're getting a house, you're going to redo the counters, you're going to tear out this old carpet from 30 years ago and redo the floor, and you're going to do all this. It can't be a lot faster than your estimate, because you actually have to do all the stuff. But whatever you're missing or whatever goes wrong will take longer. This is why everything takes longer than you want, because you don't have a lot of time to be faster and save time, you know, if you really have a decent understanding of some of the work. Yeah. But you could be missing something. So it can't go faster, but it can take longer.
And I think a lot of people fall into two categories that I see in my coaching practice and I've seen in my business life. You know, that some people are totally towards a goal and they see nothing but optimism and yes. And there's a bunch of people that see all the steps to reaching that goal and they're much more, concerned about saying yes because they, you know, get bogged down in the details of what it's going to take to get done. And they can become very perfectionistic about, doing anything. And so I do think people are maybe designed a little different or their focus is different or their skill sets are different in that way. And trying to figure out which style you are. And then I think surrounding yourself with someone who's, you know, got the opposite. My brother was because we were in business together, but unbelievable at sales strategy, you know, towards a goal. Everything was possible for the guy. I mean, we had lists and lists of projects. He was always saying yes to everything. And I was much more of the operations person. So I, you know, could see all of the obstacles and steps and timeframes and people and logistical needs. So I was a little slower on it. And I think, you know, knowing who you are and then getting that blend of a business partner can be really powerful too.
Totally. Yeah, that's one of the, and I'm actually naturally, you know, far more on the side like your brother,
yeah,
Laura. And that's why I get really, I get a lot of amazing juice out of conversations and interactions and collaborations with people like yourself, like Kai, who are like, we got to stop saying yes to things. Like, we got a backlog of 37 weeks of work to do in the next 4 weeks. Like, what the heck's going on here? This is not smart.
Right. I'll like actually write my entire book before I'll think of the sales strategy, right? Like, so it's right. It's finding that balance point.
Yeah. And this is where, you know, I think it's so important to get used to diving into when things don't go the way you want and doing analysis. Why did this happen? Right. So that you can correct it. Cause you know, there's nothing wrong, obviously, with making mistakes. You know, first time author is a phrase for a reason. It's like you tend to do the first time author things, right?
Yeah.
And make a certain set of errors. You know, first time entrepreneur, same thing. You know, new chef, just learning how to cook, same thing. You're going to probably destroy a couple of your frying pans in the process. Sorry, it's like part of the game. Right? Like, oh, you can't do it. Like, oh, don't leave the wooden thing on the frying pan, like on the edge of it, you know, when it's going to burn, right?
Yeah.
So you start making those mistakes. That's fine. I think the tragedy is when you make the same mistakes over and over and over again in life and you can't learn from them. And it's like, oh, this bad movie again? This is terrible. I don't want to. Why is this happening again?
That's my favorite joke, actually, is I don't mind having problems in my life. I just don't want to have the same problems every decade. I want to be working on new things. So, Sebastian, you know, one of the things we talk about on the show is when people are stressed, when we talked about this for a moment, but I want to come back to it. When you're stressed, when you're facing fear, you're somebody who takes on a ton of things, you've got a lot of projects, you're in a really big crunch mode. What do you do to stop yourself from making that inauthentic decision, you know, pushing through a project that you just don't feel right about or saying yes to something that, you know, doesn't make sense for you and sort of ending up in that dreadful space?
So I can answer this on two levels, right? I can answer what to do in the moment and how to deal with it on a week by week basis. We can talk about that in a minute. But first, I want to give you the answer that I think most people is not the obvious answer. And it was like a game changer, life changer for me, changed my whole life. And that's the concept of a single skill that is generalizable across domains that I call impulse control.
Yep.
I call impulse control, and mindfulness meditation trains you in it, and endurance sports trains you in it. And, you know, anything where you have to endure under pressure, whether that be making art or keeping your cool as a teacher or a parent or anything where you're just having to acknowledge your own feelings and impulses as they arise and navigate them, it generalizes across domains. And I think everybody needs to train in this. I think it's like a core part of being human. Some people, you know, like everybody, we have distributions of skills. Some people are really naturally super good at this. Great. Right.
Yeah.
Great. Like, cool. Congrats. You've got like one of the superpowers came naturally to you. That's pretty cool.
My right? son has that superpower. The guy, it's like somebody unscrewed his impulses. He just always stays cool. Doesn't freak out, right? I'm like, wow, you were just made that way. That's so lucky. But I totally agree with you. When fear is happening and you're stressed, the impulse to make that decision really gets you in a lot of trouble. And if you can take some space, right, it's can be life-changing.
So here's the thing. Here's where I think people do wrong by themselves. I think people train in impulse control and habituation and making the right decisions on the areas that they're worst at, that are most painful and stressful for them. And I think that's a devastatingly tricky, maybe bad combination, right? So I'll elaborate. Let's say somebody has an eat all the cupcakes problem. So like they're pretty good about holding off on sugar. And then once they have one cupcake, they binge and eat a whole box of cupcakes. I'm not speaking from personal experience here. I don't know why I picked this example. I'm not a guy that'll eat a whole box of cupcakes if I like get off my diet. That's not why we're talking about this, but let's pretend like it was.
Okay.
So you eat the whole box of cupcakes. After you've been so good, it's been a month, and then your family is like, oh, just have one. It's treat yourself. And you're like, stop. All right, just one. Oh, I just ate a whole box of cupcakes. Why did this happen? Fine.
Yeah.
Great. here's where people go wrong and they treat themselves wrong. They say, okay, I need to get better. I'm going to get really rigid. I'm going to make a diet plan. I'm going to do this. I'm going to do that. I'm going to like learn to notice when I want to eat the food. I'm going to deal with it and whatever. I think that's tricky. So I think if you want to actually improve at impulse control and habituation, I would pick an area that's easy to you to train in the general skill.
Yes. Yes.
So I would cross train somewhere else. I would pick something that's easy for you and get good at noticing impulses as they arise in an area that you're already pretty good at and could be better. So
absolutely.
You can learn the general skill.
I honestly feel like we could just stop the podcast here because I just want to put a big exclamation mark. Right, because of it's not about the cupcake. You're developing the skill of impulse control. And whether you do that with a cupcake or you do it with something really simple is irrelevant. It's about the skill set. So doing it somewhere simple, you have success. And then you learn how so that when you face your demons, you face the really difficult moment, in your case, the cupcake.
What are you talking about? I didn't eat cupcakes. I don't know what you're talking about.
Right? You're not. And I think that is such a big misstep for most people. They don't practice the skill, and then they're faced with the most stressful moment of their life, and you know they have nothing to go back on. I love that.
Yeah, totally. And you know, so okay, like you're terrified of writing, for instance, right? Like you want to write, it's your whole thing. Like it's your reason to tear. Like you just love writing, but it scares the hell out of you. And you don't want to write.
Yeah.
Fine. Can you practice getting yourself too clean on command? Mm. Right. Can you practice, like, what are the steps to like, I'm kind of bored and restless. I'm going to get up and like fold my laundry and clean the shelves and, you know, cause like the engaging and interrupting whatever you're doing right now and doing something else is like a skill.
Yep.
Right. And everyone has different ways of doing it. I do it by opening. I actually usually keep two notebooks, one for taking notes and writing ideas in, and one that I just write like little tally marks of like the smallest possible action I could do and then do it and then write the next action. So that's my way of doing that. So I'll write like one, like I'm confused. What do I want to get done here? Two, you know, like I like mm-hmm. down to even single sentences. Right.
Yeah.
But I find that that's the same for like cleaning the house or writing. Right. And for writing, it's kind of like decide what I want the general thrust of the piece to be. You know, Hemingway, write one true sentence or brainstorm an outline or whatever. Right. Like we could talk about writing some other time. But, you know, the general idea is, you know, I'm bored and restless. How do I like get myself to focus and take the next action is a general skill that's the exact same for cleaning or running an errand or answering your email or you know, doing research and then making a cold call that you want to make for your business development or writing a poem or outlining, you know, a nonfiction piece or sitting down and writing the nonfiction piece. I think you can train the general skill independent of the area that's very hard for you. And I just can't recommend enough that you do this and you just grow your impulse control skill. You could do this through meditation. You could do this through running, but I would do this some place where it's really easy for you and then generalize it to the areas that are harder later. So you've got a foundation of like, I know how to sense what's going on in myself and then deal with that.
Yeah. Yeah. I do this with emotional states too. You know, if you're somebody who has outbursts of anger, can you, in the next time somebody says something that just mildly annoys you, can you just not say anything? Can you just control yourself in that very quiet moment? That's not even a big deal. And it builds from there. I think it's great advice. So you've talked about a handful of practices and habits that you have on a regular basis. Are there any others that you want to share for keeping an authentic life?
Absolutely. So if you are terrified, by the way, so fear is one side of the coin of like when you want to do something and you're not doing it. A huge one to break through, and I've heard you reference this already half a dozen times just in this show, of getting other people involved. There's one format that I like if there's work that you need to do that you're not doing, that you're putting off, and that's doing Pomodoros while sitting next to somebody with them. And you can do this virtually on Skype as well. It's a little more powerful in person, but I've totally done this over video Skype. And what a Pomodoro is you do 25 minutes of work followed by a 5-minute break and you set a timer. When I do Pomodoros with somebody else there, I will state at the end of the work cycle, okay, here's what I did. I'll ask them what they did. And then we'll say, what do you want to get done in the next cycle? And, you know, inevitably you're going to say, okay, I'm going to write my play. I'm going to write poetry. I'm going to, you know, outline. I'm going to write my book, whatever. And then you're like, oh, but I really, really, really should answer this email, and it'll dawn on you. Mm. Right. Right. When you start getting in your cycle and you'll do your email for a while, but then the timer will go off after 25 minutes and you'll have to report to your Pomodoro buddy as to what you actually did, right? And then, and it's no big deal. You don't need to beat yourself up over it. Like, I'll schedule anywhere from 3 to 7 hours of these if I want to get through something hard.
And who do you pick to do this with you?
Anybody that will sit there and do some work as well.
Yeah, you have to be pretty selective, right?
I'm like not so selective. It's anybody whose company that I like and who I respect. And you know, over the years, I've managed to find people like that. Again, I'll do it over video Skype, so it doesn't have to be somebody in the same location. It just has to be somebody that will take it kind of seriously and do work as well.
That's what,
right?
I'm saying.
So,
it, you don't want it to degenerate to chatting.
You know, that happens, and a lot of times we'll set a timer for 5 minutes. And then, you know, we'll say, okay, we're going to do this cycle. What'd you do next cycle? Sometimes we'll run through. We won't even take a whole 5 minute break. We'll just keep turning the timer back on and just going through it really fast. Other times, you know, we'll talk 30 or 60 minutes between cycles. And sometimes that's valuable too. I don't always regret that.
Yeah.
If there's never a breakthrough on the work and the work doesn't happen, then you ought to rethink that if that's what you wanted. But I'm okay with there's some people that I just like their company a lot. And we chat a little bit and do a lot of analysis between things. And sometimes that's needed too, because maybe the problem with your work is you thought you were being fearful and not working, but actually you didn't know what you were trying to get done. You were a little confused. You hadn't done analysis. And sometimes sitting down doing analysis with a person, if they're kind enough to take 20 minutes to 30 minutes to talk it through with you, that's okay too.
I get huge, huge value out of other people. My work productivity goes up. I don't even know if there's a number. It's like 800-fold. For me personally, I like to work alone, but having somebody else going back and forth, thinking through ideas, especially in a creative project, I find it very helpful. And I'd love to get in on one of your Pomodoros. Pomodoros? Is that what they're called?
Yeah, let's do it.
Any other tips?
A Pomodoro jam session is what I call them, if we're going to be very precise.
How'd you come up with that name?
I don't know. I think jam session is when people get together and they just play musical instruments together, and Pomodoros are Pomodoros. So I think that's how it wound up happening. But
that's awesome.
But yeah, so that one's a pretty good one. I like to build as many fire breaks into my life as possible where I'm reflective. Again, like, you know, your son is very, very steady, and not everybody's naturally very steady, right? Some people are very reflective naturally and some people aren't. So if you're not naturally reflective, or if you're in an unreflective time of your life because you're busy, I try to build as many times that I'm naturally reflective as possible. The weekly review is one of them. I'll also try to do a monthly review. I really try to build as many opportunities as possible, because if things are going great, you just breeze through it and you're like, all right, everything's good. Check, check, check. Mm-hmm. Right. But I try to create these moments to do that. One that's been really, really good for me, that might, you know, seem a little bit eccentric at first, and I'm totally fine with that because it's amazing and I'd recommend people try it. I try to take long train rides or ferries or sometimes a ship whenever I can, whenever I have the luxury of being able to book a little bit of extra time. And I'm willing to pay the same amount of money as I would to fly, right? Mm-hmm. So, you know, I really like taking a 3-day train ride. If the train is available. So Amtrak, you know, you can go San Francisco to Chicago.
And on the train, right? Ride, it gives you, spend the time doing what?
So yeah, so I'll prep, because you're gonna go on the train, right? So I will take whatever a set of my projects are. I will usually try to set it up so I don't have internet. Like, I'll go out of my way not to get internet. If I don't already have data on my phone, I'll, you know, not go looking for it. I like it when I have no internet for 3 days in a row on the train. I love it. It's my favorite thing.
Yeah.
And I'll bring a set of books, because a lot of times I feel like, you gotta kind of let your mind ease into it if you've been frantic a little bit. You know, it can be good to just kind of chill and read for a while. You know, for other people, maybe they want to download documentaries or movies. Some people are more into that. Just whatever you can do to let your mind settle down for a while, so you're not just thrown into the train and nothing is going on.
Mm-hmm.
And I travel with other people on trains, which is also great, but I'm talking about traveling alone here, where you get really a lot of space to think. I'll always bring notebooks and blank paper, mm-hmm. and then I'll look at, you know, what do I want to be doing that I haven't been doing? What have I been doing that I don't want to be doing? and like what's going on, and I'll do analysis, and I'll bring some books with me, you know, and sometimes those will have like methodologies that'll, you know, have ways to do analysis or to analyze where you're at. But I've also invented a fair amount of things that when you have that much time and space, your mind is pretty creative and will run loose. And that'll give you a lot of deep thinking time. I remember on one train ride, I sat down and I wrote every major project success I ever had. And I wrote down everything that I considered a major like failure that like maybe shouldn't have been a failure. Mm-hmm. Do you know what I mean? So not like I tried this and like, oh wait, there's nothing on this campaign, but like I didn't finish this. And like, I really should have, like why? And I look for commonalities between them. And I actually came up with eventually like two or three factors that were present on almost every project that succeeded. And it's like, wow. And then
what were they?
Yeah. So every project that I succeeded on, I either had somebody else that I was working on it with to push things through and get them through harder times, or it had a burst incremental characteristic to it. And what I mean by that is, I mean, you get feedback mm-hmm. regularly through it, right? So, you know, if you're writing every day publicly on a blog, for instance, you can fine tune it and you're getting rapid feedback.
Mm-hmm.
From mm-hmm. people.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas, you know, if you need to write a book, you're not getting incremental feedback. You're writing, 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 writing. And a lot of books get abandoned.
Yes.
50, 60, 70, 80% of the way through. So as soon as I noticed this, I said, okay, when I get on projects, I need to turn solo projects into joint projects as much as possible by at the very least having somebody that's like advising or helping me get through it that I'm reporting to monthly. Mm-hmm. To just help me get through it when it gets hard? Or how can I recruit somebody to kind of expedite towards the end if I need to get something out the door?
Yes.
Or how can I convert something that is a, you know, more of a waterfall, all happens in one moment project? How can I convert that to something that's a little more lean, continuous feedback type of a project? So yeah, those are big ones. And then there's like certain things of like certain types of things like never worked, and certain types of things like worked pretty reliably. So, and that was, I think, due more to my natural tendencies. And that was kind of like, okay, whenever possible, I should put my strength on opportunity as opposed to taking an area that I'm weak in that sounds like it's a good idea, but in practice, that's not my thing.
Yeah.
That was an important one as well.
So you're really out there interacting with life and testing out what works for you, who you are, what your skills are, where your strengths are, where your weaknesses, leveraging other people, which is such a great thing when you see an area of yourself that potentially another person could help push you to the next level. And again, going back to the beginning of our conversation, right? What is an authentic life? It's this, right? It's navigating and figuring it out and, right, just staying on that path and staying very curious and interacting with yourself and the world, and you keep learning and growing. And it's not a static state, though.
It totally, that's dead right. And I'll say, you know, maybe one last point that really helps me a lot is I like to think about virtues that maybe other people don't think about or aren't common right now. And I find, you know, if you've ever felt some way like about something for a long time where you're like, oh, there's something that I really like that's kind of odd, or, you know, there's something that I've got kind of very uneasy about, but I don't have a way to put it into words. And then you come across an author or you make a friend that's like, oh, yeah, that's exactly how I feel. And you're like, oh, my goodness, I'm not alone. It's not just me. Wow. Right. That feeling.
Yeah.
So three values that I put that are uncommon. That are uncommon these days. Or the third one, pro-sociality, I think is a reasonably common one right now. But in many parts of the world, it's not, right? The idea of just doing things that are just good for everybody around you just because that's what we're doing, that's common in America, but other parts of the world, not necessarily. Other times mm-hmm. of humanity, not necessarily. But the first two that I have out of these three, I think a lot of people don't realize are virtues, and they sound so simple once you hear them, but maybe for some people listening, maybe this is something that they're missing. And these are probably my top two that I live by, along with pro-sociality being the kind of the triumvirate. And those are competence and Aristotelian friendship. So I think just raw competence is an amazing value. I admire anyone who is competent, right? It doesn't even really matter at what.
Yeah.
And like, I like to be more competent. So I think a lot of people don't realize that that's a core value. You know, America these days is very much about intention.
Mm.
Right. And, you know, it's all about like, well, we tried. Yeah, it was a disaster. You know, we tried to do this environmental campaign to improve the environment, and it was a total disaster. And like, we just totally screwed up the ecology here and like just did a ton of damage to this area. But like, our heart was in the right place. It's like, what? What? No, 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 no. That's a disaster. No.
Unintended consequence.
No, that's a disaster. So I'm very much into competence. But then the other one, and you know, as a philosopher, I'm sure you know the term, the whole definition of friendship these days is all like, well, you know, if that's your friend, you should love them even when they're being an idiot and a knucklehead and whatever. No, I don't buy that. I buy in the Aristotelian definition of friendship, where it's not about whether there's an advantage to friendship and not about whether it's pleasurable to be in each other's company, but whether, you know, it's really about like seeing what's good in another person and loving that. So it's really loving the best parts of the other people around you and being around people that you really admire the best parts of them, and then pair that with competence, simultaneously working to, you know, be the best versions of ourselves. So for me, friendship was always really, really, really important, but the current American version of friendship was something that was like, you know, there's kind of like, oh, that's your friend. You should, you know, if you really care about them, you should put up with the fact that they'll do X really inconsiderate thing or whatever. I don't buy that at all. I believe like friendship is really like seeing what's amazing about another person and loving that, and not necessarily being accepting and tolerant of things where the person is self-destructive to themselves or to other people, not in harmony with their values. So for me, just, you know, really trying to surround myself with people that are competent, that are pro-social, that try to make everyone better around them, and then really making our engagement and interaction and everything about how we deal with each other all about the very best parts of the people that are around me, so that they're being the best them, that I'm being the best me that I can all the time. I don't know. Those are the three kind of virtues that I come back to that I think a lot of people don't think about as much. Creativity is talked about a lot these days. A lot of education is talked about a lot these days. And I'm a big believer in both of those as well. But I think these are three that people don't talk about as much. Like really Aristotelian style friendship, competency, and pro-sociality as touchstones for me, and things that are kind of universal across maybe every domain that I try to work in.
Sebastian, I just can't tell you what I love this discussion. I'm so glad we decided to focus on the questions of authenticity. I think you've added so much value, the tips, the thoughts, the practices that you put in place in your life. If people want more information about you, your projects, where can they reach you?
Sure thing. So my brand new newsletter, my last newsletter was very popular and people really liked it. And we got a regular one coming out all of 2016, long form content. You can go to marshlist.com, Marsh being part of my last name, MARSHLIST.com. And you can also check me out at sebastianmarshall.com, which is my full website and has a list of the projects that I'm working on. And you can get updates there as well. But definitely go get on Marshlist if you want to get kind of some long form, really kind of thought out pieces that if you like this, you know, maybe you like that.
I love it. And thank you so much for offering so much value today. It was helpful to me. I've picked up a few things. I definitely want to do the 25-minute work with breaks with friends and several other things. So thank you very much. I appreciate you sharing. And maybe we'll do this again sometime.
It's a pleasure. Thanks, Laura.
Hey, thanks so much for listening. I hope you found some value in this interview. If so, it would mean the world to me if you hit subscribe, completed an iTunes review, or shared it with a friend. Every little bit counts. I'm super grateful for every single one of you, and I couldn't be more excited to be here. Signing off, I'm Laura Koh, and I'll see you guys next week.